Sarcoma Stories is a podcast created by Sarcoma Foundation of America to highlight the voices and experiences of patients, survivors, and care partners. After each episode, you can connect with others in the sarcoma community on our Sarcoma Stories podcast Facebook group to delve deeper into the episode's topics. You can find information on this specific subtype or your subtype, as well as all our podcast episodes on SFA's website, www.curesarcoma.org. Links are in this episode's description. Follow us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts to stay up to date on the latest episodes. Thanks for listening. SFA created Sarcoma Stories to highlight the individual stories of sarcoma patients, survivors, and care partners. To amplify the many stories we consistently hear and bring together the broad range of lived experiences of sarcoma patients, SFA has also created a Sarcoma Journey Survey. This survey is vitally important as we need to collect data for sarcoma subtypes to help advance research and effective treatments and put data to the stories we consistently hear. To learn more about this survey and to take the survey yourself, please head to the show notes and you'll find the survey link. On this episode, we're joined with Emily Oberst, an Ewing sarcoma survivor. Emily shares her experience navigating childhood cancer from the decision-making around surgery as an active young person to considering fertility preservation at an age when most kids are thinking about school, sports, and friends. As she transitioned out of treatment and into young adulthood, Emily found empowerment through adaptive sports. Discovering wheelchair basketball in high school, she's gone on to become a Paralympic athlete, channeling her strength and determination both on and off the court. A champion on the court and for the sarcoma community, Emily shares insights on finding courage and building confidence in the face of a life-changing diagnosis. Emily, thank you so much for sharing your journey with us. Let's dive in. Welcome to Sarcoma Stories, or welcome back if you are a regular listener. I'm Tasha, I'm one of your hosts.
And I'm Brandy, and I'm your other host.
And today we are joined by Emily Oberst. We will give Emily an opportunity to introduce herself here. But Emily is a 2024 Paris Paralympic silver medalist and our 2024 Courage Award honoree at our Stand Up to Sarcoma Gala. So Emily, thanks so much for being here. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Yes, thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to share more of my story in detail and get the opportunity to speak upon it and hopefully meet others and give a little courage to other sarcoma survivors out there. So super excited.
Well, we're so excited to have you. And like I said, you might be familiar with Emily's story from our 2024 gala, but for those of our listeners who are not familiar, Emily, could you share a little bit about who you are and how you came to even have a sarcoma story?
Yeah, so my sarcoma started when I was 12 years old. I was a pretty active teenager. It was eighth grade, and I was trying out for an AAU basketball team. And basketball was my favorite sport growing up. I played it pretty much every day. And I was trying out for this team. The trials were pretty intense. And I started feeling this pain on my left shin. And then after about a week, that pain didn't really go away. My mom took me to urgent care, which turned into needing a biopsy, which turned into ultimately hearing the statement, you have cancer. And that process completely, you know, changed my life. I was thrown straight into chemotherapy treatments right away. I went through, I think, 9 months of chemotherapy treatments, a pretty invasive surgery to remove the tumor. And luckily, after kind of a year of those treatments, I was able to ring the bell signifying that I was cancer-free, which I am super, super grateful for and have been in remission ever since. So that was when I was 12 years old. I'm now 26 years old. So it's been quite some time, and I'm very, very fortunate to be here today. And then my life kind of took an even bigger turn a few years later when I found wheelchair basketball to kind of replace that love of able-bodied basketball.
Congratulations on 14 years later. That is, you know, a really significant amount of time. And I think, like you said, gives courage to others who might be in the same position to you. But something you and I had talked about before we got on the podcast was the surgery piece of your sarcoma story. And I was wondering if you could share a little bit about that, because I do think there are other people out there who may find or have found themselves in a similar position to how you came about getting that surgery.
Yeah, I think that was honestly the hardest and most important decision within my care. So mine was localized in my tibia on my left leg. So tibia is like the big bone. It holds most of your weight for your entire body when you're walking. And that tumor kind of engulfed most of it. So they had to remove a big chunk of my bone. And I think we had three options. So the first option was they wanted to replace my bone with a cadaver bone. If that breaks, you have to amputate your leg. You're going to have like another major surgery in your life. And at 12 years old, with hopefully, you know, a life, long life ahead of you, that would have been a tough pill to swallow. Second option was completely amputating the lower part of my leg. And I didn't really want to have that happen as my first option. It would have, you know, been okay, but definitely wasn't number one option. And then the third option that we actually went with was I believe the medical term is like tibia fibula graft or something along those lines. You can fact check me. But it took the fibula out of my healthy leg, so my right leg, and transferred it to my tibia in my left leg. So they completely cut out the bone. Fibula went, they screwed it into my bone, and over time it grew to be almost the same size as my tibia. The pros of that surgery were it was my real bone. So if you break it, heals like a normal bone. The cons are it's a longer recovery process. So I was pretty much in a wheelchair for like a year and a half after that surgery. But in the end, it really, you know, was the best decision because I did end up breaking my leg a few years later. But, one of the things that really made such a difference is my mom and my dad really researched, all the options, because my local hospital in Wisconsin did not offer the fibula tibia graft as a surgery. And my parents went out seeking other families who have been through similar situations and, you know, used, you know, the web and figured it out. But we actually flew to Philadelphia where we had a surgery to do just that. And it was really a blessing. And I'm so thankful for my parents for really diving into that.
Yeah. Yeah. I know your mom's advocacy has been a prominent part of your journey, but that's a lot of decision making. And you're 12 at the time, obviously making those decisions with your parents, but that is a lot to think about. And as a child, or almost a teenager, you're thinking, what's the best decision for me with hopefully a long life ahead of me? So I have to make this choice now for myself currently and in my future. How did you with your parents make that decision?
Yeah, my parents did such a great job of shielding me of how scary cancer actually was. Like, my number one thing throughout the entire treatment process, throughout my even diagnosis, was how am I going to be active again? How am I going to play sports? I was not really nervous about dying. And now that I am older, I just did not realize that at the time of how serious it was. So I think with my surgery decision, that was the number one thing, is I was like, well, what can give me the best life in the future? I want to be able to walk around with my family, my own family in the future. I want to be able to do the things like most kids and adults do. So that's ultimately what I decided. My parents obviously took a more detailed approach and really, you know, figured out how everything was going to work, pros and cons of everything. But yeah, we all agreed with the same surgery option. So that was great. But yeah, I probably didn't fully understand the scope.
Yeah.
When you first went to the doctor, how long did it take for them to do the biopsy and move you through this process? Did you have to go to the doctor more than one time, or how quickly did that happen?
Yeah, it took way too long, in my opinion. It was the x-ray. Then we had an appointment 2 weeks later to look at the x-ray. Then it was another biopsy about 2 weeks later. And then I think it was a full month after the biopsy before we got the actual results. And the scariest part was we had an original appointment maybe like a week after the biopsy, and then they kept pushing it back. So our anxiety kept, you know, going. And They're like, no, we are not delaying this one more time. You're coming and you are telling us something. Even if it's not the diagnosis, you are giving our daughter something we need. This is crazy. So yeah, it was definitely not an easy process.
Yeah, one that definitely involves a lot of advocacy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and my mom could go on and on about that. You are the biggest advocate for yourself, and you cannot let people kind of push you around. If you need an answer, you need to get it yourself, no matter who you piss off in the meantime.
It's your life. It's your journey. Mm-hmm. You should have as much information as you can. Make mm-hmm. those decisions. Something interesting, when you had first said you went into the doctor and you got a biopsy, I thought, let's see if that happened quickly, because mm-hmm. you know, we hear stories where it doesn't happen quickly at all. And then sometimes if the doctor is paying attention and has an idea that it could be this, then it moves along a little bit faster.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and as we know with sarcoma, a month is very important. You have to get on it and get on the doctors.
You mentioned that you were worried about being active and getting back to playing basketball, and then you found wheelchair basketball, because basketball was such an important part of your life, and all of a sudden you can't do it like you used to be able to. How did you manage that through high school, which is a pretty formative part of our lives?
Yeah, I honestly kind of struggled to get back into normalcy in high school. I rang the bell the beginning of my freshman year. As a girl, all my hair was gone going into freshman year. And that was super important to me. I just didn't want people to stare at me and like, hey, that's the cancer girl. She went through a lot. I honestly didn't want to talk about what I went through or anything. I just wanted to be thrown back into a normal teenage life. So kind of getting the first 2 to 3 years, I truly like struggled after ringing the bell, just because all of my teammates were still playing sports. They were going to tournaments that I no longer was going to. They had practice every night. And it was just trying to figure out like how I was going to fit into like my new life. And it wasn't until junior year, after I was finished with physical therapy, I could walk again. I could walk with like a slight limp. So I really, the one sport I could play that didn't involve running or jumping was golf. So I got back into golf, which actually ended up bringing me to wheelchair basketball. So I joined my golf team junior year. The WIAA, which is our Wisconsin High School Sports Administration, they gave an exemption to let me use a golf cart in competitions, so I didn't have to walk the full course, which was awesome. So I started playing that. The local newspaper wrote a paper on, you know, my story, you know, an inspiration. She returns to golf. And the local wheelchair basketball coach in Milwaukee read the story, contacted my mom and said, hey, your daughter sounds like she loved basketball prior. We think she'd be great for wheelchair basketball. Have her like come out and try it. And I originally said, absolutely not. I walked in everyday life. I didn't understand how I could even qualify for wheelchair basketball. I had such a negative connotation about the word wheelchair and the word disability, because I didn't want to be seen as having a disability ever. And now that's the biggest blessing of my life, honestly. But at the time, just trying to be normal. So this coach kept persuading me. I kept saying no. Then he said, you just have to come. And my mom was like, okay, we'll go and say no in person. So we saw the sport, completely fell in love with it. Like, it was so much more athletic, fast paced, competitive. It was truly everything I loved about basketball prior, just kind of in a new form. So I joined that day, I think, yeah, junior year of high school, and then have played ever since. And then I was recruited to go to college. I didn't even know wheelchair basketball was a collegiate sport or Paralympic sport. I had no idea this world even existed. So wheelchair basketball, the thing that gave me the most is I met people with similar stories, and it gave me an opportunity to be confident and embrace my disability instead of trying to hide it. And I know that comes with age and maturity too, but that definitely helped.
Well, you touch on something important here. One, about recognizing the many different forms disability can take, but two, also, especially as an adolescent young adult, just trying to find their place in the world, throw in a cancer diagnosis on top of that, that makes it even more difficult to reconcile, like, who am I? What do I do in the world? Especially as you're in high school and surrounded by your peers who seemingly are also figuring that out without a cancer diagnosis. So it sounds like wheelchair basketball gave you this space to say, hey, this is who I am.
Yes, 100%. I met people who truly believed in me. And yeah, the confidence thing was a huge thing that I kind of lacked, honestly, coming out from a cancer diagnosis. I kind of saw I was in a little bit, to be honest, a depressed state, just trying to fit in high school. And yeah, it completely got me out of that. And I'm so, 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 so grateful.
When you were going through that, did you reach out for any resources? How did you kind of maneuver all of that?
Honestly, I didn't really have any resources. I leaned on my family and friends, and I have the best family and friends. They like were fully supportive. I've had the same friends since I was basically in kindergarten, which has been awesome. So they have known me my whole life. They integrated me in like everything they could possibly do. They were also my shoulder to cry on when I was having bad days. So I really just, leaned on them. But yeah, unfortunately, it was a while ago. So now I think the resources in high school are a lot better than they were back in the day.
You said something there, back in the day. I'm curious if with you back in the day, quote unquote, they had those conversations up front of like, if you do this surgery, this is what your life will look like afterwards. Or if you do chemotherapy, this is how it might impact fertility. Do you remember if they had those conversations with you at the time?
I remember I definitely had the fertility conversation. I think that was honestly one of the hardest things to kind of grasp, because you had to make a decision basically in a week if you were going to remove, your eggs of like a 12-year-old. And it was just honestly not enough time to even comprehend it. But besides that, I don't remember any other quality of life conversations. I think within the surgery realm, they definitely explained what I would get out of each surgery. But also, it wasn't that common. It still isn't that common. So these surgeries did not happen that often, where they had 30-year survivor stories to show you what it looks like. It's like, so that was a little difficult. It was kind of like a guessing game at that point with, as much research as they could provide.
I would venture to guess many people still feel like sometimes they're in that guessing game.
Yeah. And with the fertility stuff, like, it's still a guessing game. I have not tried to get pregnant or anything. And when I was 12 years old, I was told 0% chance you will never have kids, which is so scary to hear. Now, completely different answer. They're like, oh, we think you'll be fine. I'm like, well, then why did you say 0% at 12? So now I'm 26. So I don't know when my menopause will hit. We've heard it's early, sometimes it's not. So I don't know. And that's very hard to plan your life around.
It really is. That's so valid. And I think a topic, I thank you for your openness about that, is really prevalent in the adolescent young adult conversation. And only in the past few years has it become more so, but it is so important. Like you said, for people assigned female at birth, you really don't have a lot of time to make a decision. You have, and it's an involved process. Some people don't even have that time.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And also at 12 years old, you're not really thinking about, okay, I practically need to make a decision right now about what that looks like.
I haven't even had my first kiss at that age yet. Like, God forbid, a family. And at that point, we're only focusing on like me surviving. That's the number one thing. I have to survive first to think about having a family. So
hard to plan for that future when you are questioning, well, will I have a future? It's a balance, preserving what you can, because that's the outcome they want for you, but also keeping you alive to hopefully get to that outcome.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you continue to have those conversations with your doctor? As you mentioned, you were told that you absolutely would not be able to have children. Now it's like, well, you might be able to. And as you said, you don't even know when menopause might come on. Do you have to have those active conversations with your doctors now?
Yeah, I'm very, honestly, maybe a little too active about it. I try and get checked every 6 months because I'm so terrified that my numbers might go low and that I'll miss that opportunity, because not going to say I'm playing a game, but like kind of, as I'm seeing if I need to freeze my eggs or not before a certain time. I don't want to miss that window. So I definitely, that's the way I'm doing it. Nobody's told me to do that or not do it. But I think I would much rather know than not know.
Totally.
Absolutely. To be able to make that choice for yourself, at least have the choice, so it's not taken away from you.
The choice and plan around it, because I know that process is involved. And as somebody whose career is active, that means you have to take time off of that to do that process because mm-hmm. from my understanding, you can't work out when you're freezing your eggs. You have to keep it very calm, active person.
And a lot of the medicine and the hormones you have to have are actually illegal for Team USA. So that's a whole nother level on top of that. So I would have to either choose basketball or not. It's a whole complicated process. But
I had no idea. That's very challenging.
You're still having to deal with the cancer diagnosis and how it's impacting your life all these years later, and the decisions that you still have to make about whether or not you want to freeze your eggs, have children, Team USA. Do I decide between this and having kids?
What advice would you give to people who are finding their footing post-treatment or even during treatment? What would you say to them from what you've learned all of these years about the transition into life afterwards?
Yeah, I would say two things. I would say truly embrace like the thing that makes you unique. I know that's sometimes hard to see like right away that this cancer journey could be really positive in your life, and it's kind of what you make it at that point. And then also just you really have to find an outlet. Like mine was wheelchair basketball. It can be anything that truly makes you happy and makes you feel confident and, you know, makes you just feel good about yourself all the time. That is what, you know, helps you kind of get through those times when you're not, you're thinking about the past or kind of having a bad day, or you don't like what you see from, you know, a scar perspective or whatever it is. Truly find an outlet that makes you happy.
Yeah. And you mentioned wheelchair basketball being your outlet. So I'd love to talk a little bit about your experience with wheelchair basketball and that journey. So you found it through golf and through almost saying no to it. And shout out to your mom for having you try to go say no in person, because now that's what you're doing. So what happened from there?
Yeah, so I fell in love with the sport immediately, started playing. Wheelchair basketball is just the craziest thing. When I first started, I couldn't even make a layup because it's all upper body strength. You can't use your legs for really anything. So I really had to build up the strength to get good at it. And then once I kind of got my strength, I started being recruited by colleges. So I graduated 2016 from high school and went to the University of Alabama for 1 year. And then I actually transferred to the University of Illinois for 3 years. And overall, my college experience was awesome. I loved being a student athlete. I'm a very busy bee. So we would have practices from 6:30. I didn't love the 6:30 a.m. start time, but I did. I don't miss that one bit. But we had 2-hour practices in the morning and then like lifts, training. And then I stayed highly involved at U of I. I was in a sorority, made the best friends that I'm still friends with. So that was super awesome. And then I graduated in 2020. And as we know, it's the year of COVID. So we were sent home from university. The 2020 Tokyo Paralympics were delayed a full year. So I kind of thought I had to choose either to play basketball full time or a professional career. And I chose a professional career. And I started working at Abbott as a logistics planner, which I'm still in that role. But the 2021 was the year that the Tokyo Paralympics actually happened. And I watched my past teammates win bronze. And I really, honestly, I miss the sport so much. Like I miss the busyness. I miss the athletic life of it. And I truly like realized the one thing that I've always wanted to do is be a Paralympian and represent Team USA. So I had a conversation with my manager. Would I possibly be able to do this on the side? I might have to take a little extra PTO, or I guess not even PTO, just TO, time off, and just like figure it out. And she was in full support. So I tried out for the team after Tokyo in 2021 and was in the full cycle up to Paris and went to the Paris Paralympics this past August, where finally won a silver medal. It was honestly coolest experience of my life. Like we were played in an arena that was sold out every single game. People were cheering and booing us throughout, which I love a competitive atmosphere. it was awesome. So
will you continue on with Team USA? Or since you've gotten the silver medal, you feel like your goal was accomplished?
I thought I was honestly only going to do one. Like I thought I was going to do Paris and be done, but I still am enjoying the sport so much. And I hate that we lost the last game. It eats at me alive every day that we have a silver and not gold. So I think, yeah, LA 2028 is definitely going to happen. And hopefully we'll come out with the gold and with a final win. And it's in our home country. That's very hard to turn down.
Yeah.
Right. Well, it's not so hard to get to.
And yeah. You're thinking ahead to 2028. And I would love for you to explain to people, because you were explaining this to me before we started recording, what happens in between those years?
Yes. Yeah, so a lot of people don't realize that it's a full 4-year commitment before the Paralympics. So what happens is this first year, I have a tournament in South America. We have to get first or second, which qualifies us for a tournament the year after, which is World Championships. That would be 2027. Or 2026. Then in 2027, we'd have Parapan Games where you have to win to qualify ultimately for LA 2028 Paralympics. So it's truly 4 years of hard work. Like, it's nonstop. Like, I honestly haven't really stopped training since even Paris ended, which, thank gosh, I love this sport because otherwise I would be going crazy. But yeah, it's hard work.
That is a lot of hard work. I'm still sore from my Barry's boot camp.
That's hard too. Yesterday. The fun part is you also can incorporate fun classes like that. It's not all basketball. It's like just staying in shape. So that's good.
Yeah, my arms hurt from the arm and abs day. So I can't imagine all the layups you're doing. But as you're moving through these next 4 years and all of the time you've spent playing wheelchair basketball so far, have you met other sarcoma survivors? And what have you learned about the world of sports and Paralympics?
Yeah, I've met lots of sarcoma survivors. Two of my teammates this past quad were cancer survivors. And honestly, we've had so many late nights just talking about our experiences and how similar things are. And it's awesome just... not many people can relate to you in that sense. Like, you can't find many kids that have gone through cancer treatments. So that has been such a blessing. And yeah, it's one of my favorite parts of wheelchair basketball is you learn the most unique stories, whether it's sarcoma, whether it's cancer, whether it's a realm of disability stories. It's really life-changing.
How do you train with them between these 4 years? So next you have a tournament that you have to be prepared for. How and when do you all get together and train as a team?
So we meet together every month in Colorado Springs, which is where the Olympic and Paralympic Training Center is. We meet for like a Wednesday to Sunday time frame. And then the rest of the time, it's pretty much on your own, which is the United States kind of has a disadvantage to that because the United States is so huge. We're like all over the place. We have West Coast, East Coast. So you can't practice with your teammates. We're like a lot of the European teams are only like an hour, 2 hours away from each other. So they can get together a lot more often. It's pretty much a decentralized program. And then my individual training pretty much consists of lifting 3 times a week. We have local teams that we practice with. I'm in Whitewater, Wisconsin now. I practice with their college team. That's kind of the closest competitive team. And then throughout the year, we have our normal basketball season with our local team. So I was just in Richmond, Virginia this past weekend where we actually won a national championship. So my team came out number one in the nation, which was awesome. And that's also where we see our teammates, but we're just competing against them, not with them.
Yeah, that's very neat. And it's great that you have... an employer that really supports that and allows you to be able to participate in that journey, especially having to go to Colorado Springs once a month for 4 years to be able to, and then the time off you need for the tournaments. I'm wondering, because we've had conversations with people who talk about fear to tell their employer about their situation. Mm-hmm. Sometimes that's they're actively going through treatment or they're just diagnosed. You came into it already in remission, but still it impacts your life through Team USA. How did you approach that conversation with your employer? And were you afraid to share that part of your life at all?
Mm-hmm. I've always kind of looked at, I'm not going to say a confrontation because it's not really anything bad, but I'm very open with my thoughts. My motto is the worst thing they can say is no. So I will ask pretty much any question and they say no, and then I'll figure it out. I think most employers and managers would rather you be open and honest than trying to hide and deal with it yourself. And that's when I went in with it, and my manager couldn't have been more supportive. And especially with, if you're trying to approach something to do with cancer, whether you need time off for treatments or a loved one, everyone will be understanding with that.
Do you have people who find your story, whether it's through social media or your work with Team USA, and reach out to you who have been newly diagnosed with sarcoma and, you know, want to connect with you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think social media has been a blessing in that way. I've really tried to be more active on it, and hopefully my story can be an inspiration to somebody. And I've actually had a lot of young wheelchair basketball athletes who have been sarcoma or cancer survivors that have reached out to me. So that has been awesome. And yeah, even through the hospitals, I highly encourage, if there's any doctors or orthopedic surgeons listening to this, to really promote adaptive sports. If it's, you know, something that has affected their lower limb or really any part of their body, because that is the easiest way to kind of get the word out, because I truly don't know where I would be if I didn't find wheelchair basketball, or I might not even be on a podcast able to talk about my experience if I didn't.
That's a great point, because you think of hospital resources as recovery and treatment and maybe social work and palliative care, but that's also a great way to find resources that move you into the next phase of your life after hospitalization, or just to learn about a lot.
Yeah. And I'm very, as you can tell, open about everything. So if anybody needs anything or wants to reach out, like, my Instagram is always open for DMs or conversations. And I will always give my cell phone number to any cancer, anything. So just let me know.
Yes, we will link that in our show notes so people can reach out to you if they want to connect.
Yeah.
You were our 2024 Courage Award honoree. What does courage mean to you?
I think, honestly, courage just means strength and the way you persevere, making lemonade out of lemons. But I think every person shows courage in different ways. And with cancer, there's not really an option to not be courageous. You really are thrown into this crazy, life-changing, I don't want to say unfortunate events, but it kind of is. And you have no choice to be strong or not. You have to be strong. And you learn so much about yourself. And I want to stay humble and have a little bit of humility. I don't want to say I'm the most courageous person in the world, but I have been in this situation where I've learned so much about myself because of the cancer diagnosis.
But also, I couldn't find my way. So mm-hmm. then finding yourself to be on Team USA is quite a journey, because many people in that situation feeling depressed and not having confidence to really take that step. We all have heard that first step is often the hardest, but it does take courage. It does take that strength and perseverance and dealing with those things within your own mind that was making you feel not as confident, stepping outside of that. That takes courage to do that. But then also, I'm going to put myself out here and I'm going to try for this and I'm going to train for it and I'm going to do it. Something that we talked about previously is that disability. And I want to explore this with you a little bit. It's straddling two areas. Not everybody who gets cancer become disabled. And disabled people don't usually have cancer. And so really straddling those two worlds of finding people who can understand them both. Did you find yourself trying to straddle both, and where did you actually fit? And still trying to figure that out.
I feel like I have figured it out. I feel like people who have not really seen the sport haven't figured it out. The question I get the most is, oh my gosh, do your teammates get mad at you when you get up and walk? And I'm like, why would you think that? And they're like, well, I don't know. It's just them assuming that I have a better quality of life than somebody who's in a wheelchair full time, which is fine. Like, it's an assumption. The intent was like, they were just curious, which is fine. But I always kind of respond and I'm like, most people who I've met who are in a wheelchair full time, like, view that as such a positive. The wheelchair has given them a blessing to be able to move throughout life, because independence, it's like a positive thing. It's not a negative thing that they see in themselves. That's something I have always wanted to preach, is we're very equal. Everybody's quality of life is very equal. We've all had different stories, but That's the biggest difference. And when we were touching about the transition thing and how like I've coped in a sense, now that I'm older and realize I was thinking the worst things about myself, other people are thinking the most positive things about me in a sense. And that is what I've learned. Nobody looks at me like, oh my gosh, she has no hair. Like, oh my gosh, she's like, I'm not cute anymore. Like, nobody's thinking that. But like in my head, that's what I was thinking. And even with the disability and everything, I've just learned who cares what other people think. It does not matter. You just have to be confident in yourself and be okay. I mean, you sleep with yourself at night, right? You're not sleeping with somebody else's brain of what they think about you. So that's just my little tidbit of knowledge that I've learned.
Well, I like what you said too about the quality of life, because I think for somebody who has never been in a wheelchair full time, it would be hard to imagine a difference in how you're living your day-to-day life. That is how someone has access to the quality of life somebody walking knows. And so to assume that you have a lesser quality of life due to a wheelchair, which is a wonderful tool to give you access to these things, is an assumption, like you said. And I think it's good to have these conversations for that reason. And you do have this unique position that you're in where you live in between these two worlds, right? And can share that with the public.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. But you also said, in my head, I was seeing myself one way, but other people were seeing all these positive things about me. And I think that's hard for people to get out of how we see ourselves. And you mentioned earlier having just a fantastic network that really was very supportive of you and really helped you to get through those hard times and gave you that shoulder that when you needed to cry and just be able to have that outlet. What advice would you give to people about finding that support system?
I think you truly need to reach out to, you know, family, friends when you are struggling. I don't think it's ever a burden when somebody reaches out to me for help or for anything. And I don't think many people think that. And then also just like within the cancer realm, I think it's so important to talk to other families. There's so many families that want to help you and have this knowledge that you might not even know, or this experience that, you know, might change your life. Like for the surgery perspective, my mom talked to a family that had the same surgery as I did. And that's what ultimately kind of was our deciding factor. And there's so many organizations. SFA is one of them. There's a ton that all these parents who have been through something similar are willing to talk to. So highly encourage.
True. And you mentioned family. I'm curious, because your mom's advocacy has been such a big part of your sarcoma journey. Has that impacted how you've then gone forward and talked about your journey and been an inspiration to you?
Yes. My mom has always been open from the very beginning, and I've kind of seen her be able to tell my story to others. And now I'm older and I'm able to kind of speak for myself. And it's truly like she's given me the confidence to do it. And I've learned pretty much everything. We're basically the same person. So that has helped a lot. Just seeing her be able to, you know, make such a difference on the sarcoma community and really inspired me to do the same thing. And, you know, now that I have this Team USA platform on top of the cancer side of things, that's really my ultimate off-court goal, is to bring so much awareness and hopefully funding and money to sarcoma. So hopefully we get a cure someday.
Absolutely. Right.
That's what we're looking for.
Where are you now in terms of how you monitor your diagnosis? I think a lot of people who are in the early phases of monitoring like to know, somebody who's years out of their initial diagnosis, how is it monitored for you right now? And how do you navigate that while you also have a really busy life? Because life grows around your diagnosis the further out you get. So how do you manage all that?
Yeah, so I'm actually kind of in a transition period, because I saw my pediatric doctors until I turned 26 in August. So I've always had the same scan procedure. And that's one thing that is actually very difficult for me right now, is I have to find a whole new doctor who I have to re-explain everything to. Honestly, I haven't found it yet. That is on my to-do list. But basically, I have to find an in-network doctor who specializes. Might have to give me a whole list of what I needed to find. Basically, I need to find a new doctor to start over with those scans and treatments. I am getting an echocardiogram this year, and then I think it's just blood work. It's pretty minimal yearly now of what I need to get tested. But yeah, the struggle to find a new doctor when you were a pediatric to an adult is not what I'm looking forward to.
That is such a real challenge. And we were just this past week talking about how adolescent, young adults, pediatrics experience this transition. Like, you're in a transitionary period in your life anyway. And then your diagnosis also has these transitionary phases. And you're currently in one of those. And this goes back to, this doesn't end. You now, years out, are experiencing this new challenge of having to find a new doctor to help you transition in out of the pediatric phase into your next phase.
Yeah. That's and real. What makes me nervous is I'm going to very much be on top of it, but I can see people who, you know, get scan anxiety. They might just not find a new doctor and explain this. Mm-hmm. And that's very scary.
I'm so glad this came up. What was that experience like? You know, because of the age, you are considered a pediatric patient, but in reality, you're not pediatric anymore. You are out of college, you're on Team USA, you're living your life, you have a job, you're out in the world. As you've gotten older, to continuously be connected to the pediatric world when you felt like, maybe I don't connect with that so much. Mm-hmm. Did you feel that way?
Yes, especially going into the doctor's office and seeing all these animals on the walls. I was like, probably shouldn't still be here, but I really was just hanging on as long as I could because I just didn't want to have, I mean, starting over and explaining everything is just very annoying. And I know there's charge, I know there's things, but like when you find a doctor that knows you, it's so much easier. So then transitioning to somebody else is going, I just look at it as a pain. I'm sure most people do, even though it's necessary.
Yeah. And it's almost like getting re-diagnosed. Yeah. And having to restart the journey. Because you're right. It's not the same that somebody's been through your journey with you for the last 14 years and now you've got to find someone else.
Mm-hmm. I talk about this all the time, but cancer didn't end when I rang the bell. I'm going to have heart issues probably in the future. We're going, you know, to have all these different side effects. And I don't know what's going to happen in the future. But yeah, having to switch doctors is kind of difficult in that. In sarcoma, there's not the most research on it. There's not the most doctors that know that. So that's going to be hard to find somebody.
It also has to be kind of scary because, as you said, there's things that could happen to you for the rest of your life, you know, side effects that you have to monitor for the rest of your life. And it's almost like the trust that you had with this doctor, you've got to find that person that you trust again with your life, basically. Yeah. Also, it's almost being confronted with it all over again.
Yeah, and by myself now that I'm an adult, so I can't be spacing out at these doctor's appointments, depending on my mom to remember everything. Like, it's all to me now. And that is also scary, too, because I feel like sometimes I'm still a child and that I need my mom all the time. So, yeah, it's hard.
Listen, I'm twice the age that you are, and I still need my mom. And she's not here anymore, but I still think all the time, I still need my mom. So I completely understand what you mean. But yeah, you're still in a transitional phase of your life as well. You know, it's a scary time in general.
That's something that does get talked about in the pediatric community. Look, the pediatric community age into the AYA community. So there is, you are in that population of people who go through that transition. I think hand in hand with courage, it's natural to have fear. And how do you kind of confront the fear of these potential conditions that could arise from the treatment you've had? How do you kind of confront those fears and keep them from paralyzing you? Because it can be a very paralyzing fear.
100%. I go in waves, honestly. Some days never think about it. Other days think about it multiple hours a day. And I just kind of try to remind myself, like, I'm very lucky to honestly still be here. And I really try and live in the moment, in that present day. And unfortunately, so much is not in our control. And that is one of the things that we can't really do much about. We can get our scans, take certain medicines to try and prevent it. But ultimately, it's not really up to us. So I think It's like control your controllables. And that's what I kind of tell myself when I start to spiral a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. You have to have those things that pull you out of the spiral. And that's a really good reminder. Yeah. Control the controllables. My oncologist has actually said that to me before.
Love that. Yeah. And again, it's also an outlet thing. Like lean on your family and friends, lean on the things that you like to do. So distract yourself if you're ever having, you know, those thoughts.
Yeah. Yeah. And find that support system. And it sounds like you are that mm-hmm. for a lot of people too, in addition to knowing who your support system is.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Now you know why we wanted to honor her with our Courage Award.
Yeah.
Emily, you exemplify exactly what courage looks like when it comes to a cancer diagnosis, but also the courage to continue to put yourself out there and the courage to overcome. Right? To overcome fears that you haven't overcome, being scared, and to continue to live your life in the moment and be grateful. So I really appreciate that. I've learned a lot from this discussion today.
You guys are very courageous yourselves as well for putting this all together and giving, you know, people like me and others an opportunity to listen and learn more. So I very much appreciate it.
Thank you for saying that.
Thank you so much for your time today. This has been an amazing discussion, and we looked forward to certainly getting you more involved with the work that SFA is doing. And we were thrilled to cheer you on last year during the Paralympics, and we're going to be doing the same as you go through the journey to LA in 2028.
2028. Here Emily comes.
Thanks for joining us today. Did this episode resonate with you? You can join the discussion about this episode in our Sarcoma Stories Facebook group, linked in the show notes. If you found this podcast helpful, your feedback is incredibly valuable and helps to create more awareness about sarcoma while sharing vital resources with someone who may need it. Be sure to leave a rating and review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.